Good day, nerds, and welcome to episode 174 of the Nerd Cantina Show. And today we've got a cantina conversation between our book reviewer, Megan McCarthy-Bianc, and the author of The Social Warming, Charles Arthur. Social Warming is a book that is right up my alley. And since reading the review and listening to Megan, I've added the book to my bookshelf as it's really an extension to some of the other documentaries and things that have come out, like The Social Dilemma on Netflix. It's full of facts, examples, all about how social media is polarizing our population, poorly informing us, and the negative consequences that were unforeseen at the beginning. They're pretty well known now, but continue to negatively affect society with little change unless people bring it to the forefront and inspire it. Take a listen here to this review. Hear more about some of the examples that they provide, as well as what kind of drove Charles Arthur into writing this book in the first place. Without further ado, here's Charles Arthur and Megan.
All right. We've got Charles Arthur here, his most recent book, Social Warming, The Dangerous and Polarizing Effects of Social Media, is available now. Thank you so much, Charles. This book was so well-researched and informative, and I really enjoyed digging a little deeper into some, you know, heavy stuff that's going on, you know, that everybody, whether they like it or not, we're all a part of it. So thank you so much for joining us to have a little chat today.
Hey, pleasure.
So before we get started, why don't you go ahead and give a quick little, you know, synopsis of what the book's about in case nobody, our listeners, may be unfamiliar with it.
Okay, so people may have heard of social media. It's quite popular these days. My sort of theorem, the underlying idea is that our growing use of social media, the fact that it moved from just being on computers that were on desks to being in smartphones that are in hands, means that we're using it more and more of the time, and that the characteristics of social media are that it sorts for what's true, it just sorts for what gets a reaction. And what actually turns out to get a reaction from us human beings is stuff that we find outrage. So it tends to polarize, it tends to drive us into the people who agree with the thing that's outrageous, or the thing, or the people who disagree. And then the people who disagree don't like the people who do agree. And so you're bumping into these people all the time on social networks. You're being shown these things because it increases engagement, because that's some feedback loop that is encouraging this process, getting everyone a bit more angry, a bit more polarized. And it's a process that, unless you're aware of it, is very insidious and very wide ranging. Same as global warming. You drive your car around, just adding that little bit in. And once you start to be aware of it, you can spot it happening. And as much as anything, you can start to think about solutions.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's, I mean, obviously you're the author. That's a very great summary of what's in the book, but it's just so, like, stuff like that, like in the book, it just branches off into so many, you know, implications, and some that we see on the surface and some that we don't see on the surface. And, you know, so it's so fascinating. And I loved all the little information. Like, I feel like anybody who disagrees that social media, like, ultimately divides content providers and users as just needs to read your book. That's like, you know, that's kind of how I feel there. So you were technical editor for The Guardian for a while, a long time. And then your work background, your professional background is mostly in, you've been able to like follow the industry and to see different technologies emerging. So how has your career maybe put you in, or your career moves anyway, have put you kind of in a unique position to follow these trends and to identify them?
Well, I mean, I'm sort of so old, I've seen a lot of technology come along. So, you know, when I first worked in an office on a computer paper, we were actually typing on physical typewriters, and we used actual carbon paper to make copies of stuff, which is something you just don't find these days. Then, you know, got the first word processors. Then we moved to things like actually having layouts done on computers, mobile phones, internet. You know, I've sort of seen all these things come into journalism. Social networks and social media has had a really transformative effect on journalism, I think, because journalists really like to know what's going on. They like need to be told, not the people people who are saying things on Twitter or on Facebook. But it does have this distorting effect because we tend to pay attention to the things that are easily found more than the things that are actually important to talk about.
Yeah, yeah. And I like how you bring up the journalistic aspect of it because, you know, you kind of saw it firsthand where, and you kind of touched on this before, where, yeah, like mostly things that will get a higher response rate and higher engagement are sensational. And where you bring up examples in your book is where a lot of things that people react to, unfortunately, is not true. Like, so kind of going off of that, like, why do you think the like false information spreads so much faster and wider than the truth?
Well, there's some really interesting studies on this, which have been replicated multiple times. And the thing that news needs to catch our attention is to be attention grabbing. It's sort of, you know, definitional. But for that, you need something which is surprising, which is out of the ordinary, which is not expected. You don't expect to hear that the president is still alive today, because that would not be surprising news. If you're told the president's been shot, okay, that would be dramatic news. And you can understand why for many people, you know, the JFK moment, for example, for those who are that old, is a defining moment. Or people landing on the moon, again, it doesn't happen every day. So the thing that fake news has is fake news can be anything. It's not bound by what's true. It's bound by what catches interest. So you can have crazy examples. Like there was one that I cite in the book about a guy who said Tucker Carlson has been killed in a car crash on his way home from Fox News. And this, of course, got a lot of clicks, but completely untrue. He said it was a satire, but you know, that's a sort of quick get out to evade Facebook's fact. The reason why fake news and false news and, you know, things that are made up have this great advantage over the truth is they can be surprising. They're completely unbound by reality, and you can make as many of them as you can dream up.
Yeah, and there's also that, you know, you don't need to go into the deep research or to like go to do the fact checking. It like then and it takes that kind of takes a little bit more time than to just say something that you know isn't true. And then so I guess, yeah, that's like another way that you kind of touch on that in the book too, is where the sheer volume when like Zuckerberg had adopted, or he had employed or partnered with a fact-checking organization to do go through all the content. It was like, you know, I'm thinking when he first came up with Facebook, he probably didn't picture that it would turn into like such this huge, controversial even, but huge platform that it's turned into today. And then unfortunately now he's got to, because he wants people to be able to share content and connect with each other and everybody to have a voice. It's like, you know, the downside of that is that everybody has a voice, you know, it's almost like everybody has a vote. Like, you know, unfortunately, like maybe they're not educated, or maybe they don't have good research skills, or maybe they don't have good judgment. And, you know, people either say false information or they share the false information. And they're not, you know, they're kind of just taking people's word for it instead of looking at it in an objective manner. And going off of like the fact checking thing, it's, you know, why it's, you talked about in the book where it's just they couldn't keep up. The organization couldn't keep up with everything that was going on.
Yeah, I mean, the fact-checking thing is really interesting because, as you say, Facebook, after the 2016 US presidential election, realized that it had a problem with fake news on its network. And so it hired fact-checking organizations who would be sent stories that looked a bit flawed, a bit false, and they would check them over and say, well, yeah, this is true, this is mostly true, this is false, whatever. But the thing was, it was like the never-ending cup of coffee. It's like if you go into a, you know, go into a restaurant or something, and they say, you know, we got the coffee cup, and it's your coffee cup will never be empty. That's great. You take a sip of coffee, and they come along and fill it up. And the whole idea of this gigantic scheme of you know, passing news around, being used by publishers in this way, never in his wildest dreams early on would he have thought of. And that's part of the big problem with the social network, is that for all the people who founded them, you know, the Jack Dorseys and so on Twitter, they, you know, they didn't mean it to be like this. They had the best of intention, but the reality is that the unintended consequences are far worse than the good things that the social networks do.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's and then that's kind of like what brings to them, like with after the election and you know, with all the false information, unfortunately, that they're finding, or at least it was almost like the boom of the false information. They're finding that, you know, they're walking the tight line, because how do they regulate without violating their own mission? And on the other side of that, you know, kind of like the cynical reality is because, you know, if you tell people they can't freely produce content, then they're not going to use the platform. And then there goes your bottom line. You can't sell, you can't reach as many mm-hmm. people with advertisers and, you know, third party advertisers. And that opens up a whole new can of worms. And that's really, like, you kind of mentioned it too. And you know, you come with the receipts, you're well researched, you cite so many things where, you know, it's the congressional hearings, I think, where they were kind of like stumbling and backtracking and, you know, they had their own policies used against them almost, but it's, and then I think Congress tried to kind of, there was like, I think the bill was like section 230 of some bill where they were trying to find a way to allow these platforms to still host the content without being responsible for it, you know, for what people are producing. And then it's that way they could kind of be off the hook. But then also, you know, it's like, oh, don't worry, our users are using the platform and you could look at how many people you can reach. And this is how much, you know, ad space you can get, or how much, you know, these are the plans that you can buy. And these are how many people you can reach, how many people could see your ad. And that, like, just goes in the whole, yeah, you open Pandora's box almost that way.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, you are seeing second order effects now. So the first order effect is that Facebook gets, and Twitter as well, but Facebook more because it has much stronger amplification. So with Facebook, you get all the fake news and all that sort of stuff, which really run rampant during the 2016 election. But after that, you then get the second order effect where Facebook realizes it has a problem and it starts trying to get rid of some of this information. It starts to try to remove it, even though it's sort of palming it off on the fact, you know, actually it's doing this itself. But then you get the second order effect where by all the fake information starts to snowball and get its own life. And that's how you get things like the whole anti-vax movement and the QAnon stuff. And, you know, you can roll in a bit of flat earth stuff in there as well. You get all these sorts of contrarian identities on where people describe themselves by sort of very strange beliefs, which don't stand up in the real world, but which they find comforting, because in a world where things are changing all the time, where things are difficult to understand, where it's difficult to be certain what your information sources should be, these sorts of beliefs give people a lot of comfort because they're very simple. You know, there's you, you're the good people, and there's them, they're the bad people. It becomes very tribal again. And that appeal to the tribalism, outrage, those are the things that you have to be wary of. And that's the problem that Facebook now has fundamentally, which is almost destructive to Facebook and destructive to the societies that it touches. Very broad effects. You know, QAnon has sort of affected, you know, there are people who believe it's true in multiple countries. It isn't true, but there's no way to dissuade them of that. And there's no way to stop the snowball rolling down the hill either. Facebook won't do it. It won't just blitz. And the fact of the only way that you could really stop it happening would be to break Facebook apart, to stop there being a nexus for this sort of information to be passed around. And that's something that Facebook is never going to do. You're never going to, you know, kill yourself in order to stop the infection. But the infection is really bad.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And yeah, it's like it's almost like they've kind of lost control and it doesn't seem like they want to rein it back in, or like, I don't think they could if they tried. And it's
no, it's very clear that Facebook doesn't actually know the extent of disinformation on the network. They've literally said this to the White House, because the White House was getting really frustrated. The Biden White House was getting very frustrated over vaccine disinformation. And the extent to which people were not getting vaccinated, having, you know, had a good rollout earlier in the year. And Facebook said, well, look at all this, you know, stuff that we've taken down, to which the White House said, yeah, but how much bad stuff is there? You know, how much vaccine disinformation have you got on your network? And Facebook doesn't know, because it doesn't know what disinformation looks like. It doesn't have a way to recognize. And if you can't recognize what the bad stuff is, then your network is out of your control.
Oh, yeah. So it's like kind of like, you know, what would, and you kind of allude to this in the, you know, kind of towards the end of your book, it's like kind of like, what do you see any, you know, strategies or methods that these social platforms could employ in order to kind of mitigate the problem?
Well, I mean, the book is called Social Warming because I do think that the problems that we're seeing are like global warming, that it's something which results from lots of tiny choices by colossal numbers of people, where they all have an additive effect, accretive effect. The question is whether fixing it is like the ozone hole, which was caused by CFCs in the atmosphere, where actually there was a comparatively small number of manufacturers. So if you control the manufacturers, if you actually regulate them, then you can have a dramatic effect and the ozone hole is repairing very quickly. Or is it like global warming, where I'm afraid to say that I think that, you know, fixing global warming, slowing global warming is a problem that's quite possibly beyond the scope of humanity as it stands at the moment. Yeah, but the thing is with social networks is that there's not that many of them. You know, there's Facebook, Twitter, there's sort of, you know, there's a few big ones. You know, you could gather all the chief executives in a room. And if you do that, if you get them to think that there's a problem that they need to regulate, then possibly you can do something. There is a problem that they're in different countries. But I mean, I think actually the simplest solution that you see is simply that small networks don't have big effect. It's when you get the really big networks, the Twitters and the Facebook, that's when you start to get bad effects, because as the size of a network grows arithmetically, so if you go from 100 people on a network to 200 people on a network, the number of interactions that they have can grow geometrically. So you go from 100 times 100 interactions to 200 times 200 interactions. That's four times as big. And the problem of moderating it and the problem of runaway misinformation grows geometrically as the size of the network grows arithmetically. So what you have to do is just cut back the size of the network. So you have to actually say, okay, Facebook, you're too big. We've got to break you up. You can have this many people in a geographical area, but you can't spread across, you know, you can't go beyond, say, 250 million users. That'll sort you out for America and Canada, and then you've got to do something. You say to Facebook, I'm sorry, Facebook, you know, you're really big, but 250 million users will do you for America and Canada. But if you wanted to have another one for Europe, then you've got to set up a whole completely different network, which will be completely separate. And that's the sort of way you've got to be surprisingly aggressive. It's a really bad.
Yeah. And then if they ended up doing that, they would get so much pushback. You know, doing something like that, even though it's necessary, it seems almost impossible.
Politically, it's a very, very big ask.
Yeah, exactly. So what do you see, like, you know, we talk about like all the dangerous and polarizing effects, how it's like dividing us and how it's had horrible, you know, implications of violence and, you know, these like-minded people. You know, you don't necessarily want white supremacists or racist people like getting in large, you know, making those connections with each other. Unfortunately, it's, you know, some of these platforms have been kind of like a breeding ground for the radicalization of that, of those individuals. So like on the other side of that, do you see any like good that social media has done?
Oh, sure. And, you know, just on the small day-to-day effects, you know, a place like Twitter during the pandemic has actually been really useful for making it visible when people who are knowledgeable about the topic of, you know, virology and vaccination and, you know, what sort of measures are effective, what measures aren't effective. It's been really terrific for that sort of. So in terms of making experts more visible, it's been terrific. Similarly, you know, a classic case is, you know, the killing of George Floyd, which was put on Facebook, and that's where it started to gain traction. I mean, you know, you don't necessarily need a social network for this thing to be effective. You know, the beating of Rodney King in Los Angeles by Los Angeles police happened a long time before social networks. That was caught on video camera. You know, that caused a lot of outrage as well. The fact of visibility is useful and it can have social benefit. It's just a question of, you know, how good is the social benefit and how useful is that compared to the downsides that we do see. All these things are a balance, and my issue is just that it seems that the downsides really outweigh the upsides as it's configured at present.
Yeah, no, that's true. Because, yeah, it does accomplish the original mission of bringing people together, giving everyone a voice. And, you know, for example, I don't know if I would have, you know, been able to reconnect with some of my family members who don't live in the country, or even family members who I have lost touch with for at least 12 years. I remember being able to find them on Facebook, and I was like, oh, holy shit. Like, oh my God, like, how are you? You know, I was able to like reconnect with people who were very special to our family. And we've been able to continue our friendships, our relationships. And same with my family members who live in Mexico. I don't think we would have been able to continue such a strong, at least keeping up with each other and being able to communicate with one another so easily had it not been for social media, you know, or even just seeing them on Instagram and sending them a quick message and commenting on a picture or something like, and then vice versa, them commenting on mine. That's just adding those interactions that, you know, it's just, it makes it easy and it makes us, you know, those are the good things where you can kind of make those connections. But then, yeah, it's like on the flip side, you see all this bullying going on. And unfortunately, I watched The Social Dilemma on Netflix. You probably are familiar with that. Where it kind of focused on, unfortunately, the adolescents that are growing up now have, it's like at 12 years old. Yeah, it's like at 12 years old, they started seeing Facebook and Instagram. It's like, I don't know where I would be now if I like had the access and needed that validity and needed that like reassurance or comparing myself to other people at such a young age. And now they're seeing the connection, unfortunately, to adolescent like depression and suicide even.
Well, I did actually write a whole chapter in the book, which we left out for reasons of space, but there does seem to be a strong correlation over a number of years, if you look at different countries, between increasing use of smartphones by children and the extent to which children say they're happy. You know, correlation and causation, not the same thing, but you know, certainly seems to be going together. It may be that there are other factors such as, you know, concern over, you know, global warming and whatever. You know, it's rather hard to measure that because that's not a sort of question that's asked in the things, but yeah, certainly there's a concomitant rise there. I mean, the social dilemma to some extent overplays things. It overplays the sort of Machiavellian idea that sort of suggesting that there's evil manipulation going on. And to some extent, it's sort of innocent manipulation. It's self-interested manipulation. There's not an intent to harm. There's just an intent to sort of, you know, show people adverts. And the problem is that when you let algorithms run riot and when you let them get really good at things, then they're going to do things without any interest about the humans who they affect. You know, right. Algorithms are amoral in the sense that they have no idea what morals are. You know, a moral, it's just an alien concept. You can't program morals into machine. And so if you have algorithms that are programmed to, you know, show people things that are engaging, they're going to show you stuff that's going to be, you know, outrageous, that's going to get you to hit the retweet button or the quick tweet button saying, isn't this disgusting? Isn't this terrible? Or isn't this hilarious? You know, owning the libs or what? And that's your, if that's the way that the algorithms go, then you start have a problem. And Facebook has had this problem and YouTube has had this problem where they've tried to set up algorithms to go against some of the other algorithms, where they're trying to, you know, so Facebook is both encouraging people to connect, but also setting up algorithms that run completely separately, which are trying to find people who are generating terrorist content. So you get the bizarre situation where you have Facebook encouraging people to join terrorist sort of Facebook groups and writing sort of, you know, what I did on my birthday things for terrorists. And yet at the same time, trying to zap terrorist accounts. And the reality is that the zapping algorithm is less good at the job than the one that gets people to join, because the one that gets people to join groups more generally on Facebook is better for Facebook than one which zaps people, because, you know, it wants to have people on the network so they can show them out.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And it's almost like a gold mine for advertisers, especially when you reach that age group too. It's like, oh, we can target these young people, you know, because it could be argued that because all of this, like all these platforms and all these things are like everybody's reachable in their hand now. Like companies can, and anybody could reach anybody in the palm of their hand, like almost 24/7. And so like, whereas versus, you know, advertising in the past was like, you know, TV or radio or billboards, what have you, print. And so now that's like opened a whole new, you know, gateway, and not, you know, that's just like, oh, well, these teenagers are watching these shows or they're listening to this music or whatever, you know, however teenagers just spend their time, in the past, like, you know, 20, 30 years ago, now it's like, well, their phone's in their hand all the time almost. And you can, if they're scrolling, you could show them an ad. And, you know, it could go so many ways. And it's crazy. It's because it's like, you know, yes, this is good for, you know, maybe other companies making money or more opportunities for growing revenue, but it's also, you know, the bad side of it. It's you're kind of making these young people like questioning their appearance and comparing themselves to influencers and other celebrities. And it's, yeah, it's like you want to see the good, but that there's also horrible, there's also horrible things going on too. And unfortunately, it's, you know, money rules the world. So there's not much that can be done about one way or the other.
I mean, I think that one of the things I touched on is political advertising, which I think is a big problem that Facebook, again, has not really faced up. The capacity to tell lies in ads on Facebook means that they're effectively beyond the reach of all the sort of regulatory agents. And the difficulty with things like dark ads that are shown to small groups, even though Facebook has an ad library now, which is a big step forward from 2016, the reality is you still don't know why particular ads are shown to people, or you don't know which people ads are shown to you. All you get to see is an ad with something particular in it. And but you don't know, is this being shown to coal miners? Is this being shown to solar panel installers? Who's this actually targeted at? What are they trying to change in their thinking? And there's a very salient point in the book, which you referred to, which is from the congressional hearing when Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez was questioning Mark Zuckerberg. And she was saying, so can I tell a lie in a political ad? And she sort of cited, you know, could I say that a certain Republican is in favor of the Green New Deal?
Right.
And he sort of swallowed a bit, and he sort of said, well, I don't think you should lie, which is actually a way of saying, yes, you could say. And this is a big problem. You know, if you're allowed to tell absolute blatant lies in an advert, and there's no recourse, there's no taking that ad down for saying,
yeah,
I see, you know, you can fact it, because it would be taken down if it was fact checking if she was just to put it as a Facebook post, but it won't be as an advert. Why? What is the essential difference between the two? You pay money for one, you pay money for the other, but you can pay money for a Facebook post sometimes. There's no essential difference there. And this is all the problem of social networks being built for engagement, not for truth, not being built for accuracy. And the same is true for Google. You know, when you do a search on Google, the results that you get are not necessarily about truth. They're about what's the most popular. Google started out as based on a scientific principle, which is that scientific papers that get the most citation are the ones that are reckoned to be authoritative. But with Google, while that worked really early on in the first days, nowadays, things that have the most links to them aren't necessarily true. They're sort of authoritative in the sense that, yeah, they're really popular, but that being popular doesn't make you right.
Right. Right. No, for sure. So like, what do you think then, you know, what advice do you, I guess it maybe is like a two-part question. What, you know, what could people do to practice more, you know, for lack of better words, objectivity, like make sure that they're not going to be fooled by false information? And then, you know, how could I, you know, cause I have a 4-year-old and an 8-month-old, and you know, obviously this stuff isn't going to be going away. They're probably going to get their own phones and own social media sites or whatever is going to be available in 10 to 15 years. What are some things that maybe I could do to prepare them to try to just be diligent and to be smart and to be also like kind of just to protect them from, you know, the dangerous effects of what they might encounter?
Okay, so the first thing is to take more of a helicopter view to sort of, when you see something, don't get immersed in it, if you can help it. Try to check claims that you see if you understand them. Take a look at resources such as Wikipedia, which is so amazing for so many things, because the great thing about Wikipedia is you don't get stuff that's just written for the sake of it. You know, you get references. You can follow the references back. Anything about, you know, stuff relating to the pandemic, relating to you know, what is a virus, how does it work, what is a spike protein, what is ACE2, what are enzymes, all these sorts of things. These are all dealt with in, you know, what is clearly, I think, one of the greatest pieces of work actually that humans have come up with. And that's a great place to start. Be dubious about claims that confirm the biases you have. Go and check them. And and more generally, I mean, the sort of more general advice, I guess, for your kids, but also, you know, for anyone listening, is recognize the sort of form that these things come in. So things that that are meant to get your reaction, the outrage tweets, the outrage posts, the things that are meant to get you to go, oh, that's really disgraceful, and to, which are sort of begging you to retweet them. Those things are so common, and they're so frequently a misstatement of what's actually happening, or they're an overreaction to what's happening. You know, there is no distinction between, you know, the president decided to bomb China, and, you know, next door has sort of said something nasty about my cat. You know, on Twitter, they both fit into 280 characters. But, you know, one is actually more important than the other. And getting a sense of perspective on these things, again, you know, getting a helicopter view is really important. So, you know, a lot of the time when I'm on Twitter, I'll look at things and I'll go, oh, look, there's an outrage. Oh, look, there's another outrage.
Yeah.
And, you know, it becomes really easy to resist once you have this way to categorize, once you're actually able to see things for what they are. And when you see people getting really steamed up about something, it's always worth saying, is this actually important, or is this something where either they've misinterpreted it, or it's really important to them but not important to anyone else, or right. It's used to be important, is no longer important. There's lots of topics like that, and you have to be aware of them. And there, you know, one of the things particularly to be aware of is that there are things that I describe as scissor statements. There are statements which basically look to cut people into two groups that try to create tribes instantly. So it's been interesting in the past few months just watching one of them grow up on the social media in the US, which is critical race theory. You say those three words and people know immediately which side of it they are. They have no idea what it is. They couldn't describe it as bad if you held a gun to their head. But they know if they think it's a good thing or a bad thing. And that's the sort of thing, again, to watch out for, is to be wary of these sorts of phrases that demand that you sit on one side or the other, have a razor sharp edge, and that insist there's no nuance, because actually there's nuance in everything. It's how politics happens, is that you're able to persuade people to take a different view about something. And I think that's really the thing you have to do. You have to beware of the ways that you know, social media will try to polarize. You have to stand outside it a little. You have to stand above it and, you know, see our behavior for what it is, which is driven very much by our primal instincts. You know, there was a time when there were very few humans left on Earth. You know, there was disease and there was ice ages and stuff, and they survived by being tribal. So our tribal nature is really baked into us, and the outrage that gets people thrown out of the tribe is also baked into it. And, you know, the amplification that social media does, which, you know, they do it because they want to share your ad, but the tribalism, the outrage, the amplification by algorithm, all these things come along, and then the social networks have no interest in moderating, which is how you'd actually control it. So you get the feedback, you get the bad effect, you get the social warming. So the way to get past it, the way to survive it really, is to recognize it for what it is and to stand a little askance at it. And yeah, always check things before you retweet them.
Yeah, no, that's solid advice to keep in mind. So basically it's like, you know, look at the sensationalism of it, of what they're trying to get a reaction out of you, and then look at statements if it's clearly dividing, if it's clearly trying to get somebody to, you know, there's maybe no gray area. There's not necessarily any wiggle room. It's they're clearly trying to say one side or the other. But that's good. I like to think of myself as having good judgment, but that's a very good concrete, straightforward advice to go about doing it. And something that's easy to reiterate to other people too. One more question before we wrap up here, or maybe two more questions. So, where do you see social media heading? Like, where do you see it? It could be maybe that's a loaded question, or maybe very generic, but kind of like, where do you see it going from here on out?
Oh, I think TikTok really shows you the shape of it. So TikTok doesn't have any sort of obvious things. You're not telling it your interests. It infers what your interests are from how long you spend on videos, how much you scroll, what you spend time on, what you don't spend time on. And it refines and refines and refines. And they have gigantic teams of engineers working on the algorithm, trying to get the algorithm figure you out as quickly as possible. So that's where I see social media going. Doesn't have to be necessarily based around video, though, you know, people find that very engaging because it's easy to just let it play in front of you. You don't have to even do the work of reading. But, you know, you could sort of imagine that a Twitter that was as finely honed as TikTok would just show you just those particular tweets that get, you know, reactions or responses from you that make you spend the longest time. So, yeah, it's going to be a real war of algorithms where they try to get you spending as long as possible, try to infer what your interests are as quickly as possible, try to draw from as broadly as possible. So things that are more absorbing, more just superficially attractive.
Right. No, that's a good point. I don't have TikTok. I'm assuming you don't have any social media. I think I found you on Twitter.
Oh, I'm very much on Twitter.
Yeah. But just not anything else really. But I guess in your line of work, you have to be on something, right?
Well, for journalists, it's pretty much obligatory to be on Twitter, just because, you know, lots of people are on it. It's not as if the whole world is on it, but you can often find people who have useful views, or you can get some sort of idea of the temperature around. If you're writing about technology, then yes, you get an idea of the technology is a big thing on Twitter, politics as well, science as well. So, pretty much obligatory. And it's totally great for sort of adrenaline junkies, because, you know, I was writing daily news for 20 years. Daily news is something where there's no stopping. You're always wanting to find the next thing. So, you know, Twitter is great for Facebook, much less so. I've never quite engaged with the idea of having to, you know, you follow back someone, they're your friend, you're their friend. And that's sort of how journalism is. You know, journalism, you don't quite have friends in the same way. You just have millions of acquaintances.
Right. Or, it's, you know, your professional network, I guess. That's another word to put it. One more before we wrap up here. So what's next on your plate? What can we look forward, you know, to reading or listening from you? What are you working on?
I'm doing some bits of journalism here and there. I'm thinking about podcast projects. I'm thinking about a book project around global warming this time, you know, so, you know, the actual thing. But they're sort of yet to fully form. I know what the idea is, but I don't particularly want to say it yet. Just still in the research stage, because I need to get the research really baked in.
Yeah, no, this makes sense. You want to make sure you do it right. And you're probably still, I mean, this book, Social Warming, it's been out for maybe a couple of months now, not even. So you're kind of still writing the coattails, I guess, and, you know, doing your press and all that for this book. So I would say, you know, you got some time and you got plenty of stuff on your plate for now anyway.
Well, it only came out mid-August in the US. So, it's pretty new for American readers.
Okay. I thought the publication date was like June, but that was for the UK then.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Perfect.
If you've got any listeners in Korea, then we just sold the translation rights there. So look forward to that one.
Okay. Awesome. All right. So thank you again, Charles Arthur, book Social Warming, The Dangerous and Polarizing Effects of Social Media. And then, so the release date for the US is when again?
It was 10th of August. So
10th of August. Oh, perfect. Yeah. Awesome. All right. So August 10th. It's out now. Thank you so much. I had a great time talking to you. I didn't have this great and engaging conversation. You've given me a lot to think about, a lot to consider. And I don't know if I'm going to quit social media, but at least I'm on to them.
Just use it. Yeah. Use it better. That's the thing. Just use it better. You know, don't contribute to the warming. You know, it's like switching from a gas powered, you know, car to an electric vehicle.
Yeah.
It's that sort of difference.
Yeah. Just be, easier. You're one person, just like with global warming. Like, yes, you're just one person, but, you know,
every person makes a difference.
Exactly. Exactly. So awesome. Thank you so much. And, you know, we'll keep an eye out onto your other projects and stuff. And, you know, thanks again.
Thank you.
All right, nerds. And thank you for listening to this Cantina conversation between Charles Arthur and Megan. We greatly appreciate Charles coming on and discussing his book, The Social Warming, The Dangerous and Polarizing Effects of Social Media. This is an incredibly important topic. It should be important to most of the nerds out there. So pick up a copy if you haven't already. Listen to it on Audible, whatever you need to do, but educate yourself on this important topic. And come back and educate yourself on some other important topics that we'll cover in our weekly show. So just make sure you subscribe, share, like, just come back for the Nerd Cantina weekly. And we'll continue to try to have these kind of conversations, elevate these topics, and have a good time. Until next time, talk to you later, nerds.